You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The Wanderer by Stacy Stowe. All through this time in Africa, Beard had never fully forgotten his establishment roots. After a brief marriage to model and socialite Minnie Cushing failed, Beard spent time in the Payne Whitney Psychiatric Clinic in New York. Friends say he was despondent. Through her social secretary, Cushing Coleman, as she is now known, declined to be interviewed. In 1972, Beard bought a six-acre property in Montauk for $135,000. The small shingled buildings are simple, but the spot is dramatic, high on a bluff of sandy cliffs that drop some 50 feet to the sea. Beard sometimes left his gate with the words "Land's End" carved into its wood, open to surfers. Beard was inherently peripatetic, though, still traipsing continents, a trait Teagues says she thought would fade. Speaking last spring from her home in Los Angeles, she described him as the most handsome man on the planet. They married 3 years after they met in 1981, and Teagues was enchanted, happy, she says, to toggle between the points of his life. Beard's nephew, Anson H. Beard, remembers being a kid flying over the Montauk Hills with the couple in Teagues's red 1980 Mercedes 450 SL convertible. Peter would say, "Floor it," and Cheryl would tell me, "Buckle up, honey." When Beard's dear friend Bacon wanted to dine with the couple in London, but expressed a dislike of eating in public, Teagues rented a suite at London's Connaught Hotel. She ordered extra furniture and hired caterers and butlers. "He held out his hand, and he pulled me up to another level in my life," says Teagues. During days in Kenya, they would drive around in a Land Rover, searching for animals to photograph. They would keep the flaps of their very Ralph Lauren tent open, and from a four-poster bed watch giraffes and warthogs pass by. But Beard wasn't able to stop vanishing. For 4 days, he'd be an angel. We would lie in bed, watch movies, hug, snuggle. But then he'd be off and running, says Teagues. That's not a marriage. In the weeks after his death, Teagues says, she read through beautiful letters that he wrote to her from Kenya while she was in New York during a career high. In some of them, he urged her to return to him, despite her professional obligations as one of the highest-paid models in the world. "I wasn't nice to him. He wasn't nice to me. We had battles. We had love," she says. "I think he likes to shock people." In the photos, A Country Mile, detail of Beard's scrapbook-style diaries. Beard reviewing a shot for Gillies Turles, The Art of the Maasai. Beard in Montauk, New York, photographed by Walter Luce. Beard reclining in Toronto. Cheryl Teagues and Beard dancing at the 1982 Scenery Greenery Celebrity Cocktail Party. A young Zara clings to Beard as he works in his diary. Jackie O, photo lesson, the former First Lady in Beard's distinct collage style. "Peter's personality is so bizarre," Teagues says. "I don't know if you could ever carve out all of the things that made Peter who he was. He was incredibly mean and incredibly intoxicating and interesting." To dissolve the tension, Beard and Teagues met with a marriage counselor who took down a book from the shelf, fanned through it, and said to Beard, "Have you ever heard of bipolar disorder?" Beard was officially diagnosed with the condition in 2013. Teagues says Beard's mood swings made him unpredictable and cruel. "I loved him deeply, but I didn't know," she says, trailing off. He hurt me so much, so deeply. He could be brutal, she says. He was abusive, physically abusive. The disappearing, it was emotionally abusive. It just got to be intolerable. She says Beard was desperate to become a father, but that she had a few miscarriages. Was Beard's violence the cause of any of them? Teagues pauses before she quietly replies, possibly. The couple divorced in 1986. Mark Greenberg, a photographer who worked with Beard on The Art of the Maasai, says as part of their divorce, Teagues took possession of her photos. Greenberg says Teagues not only cut the negatives, but removed postage stamp size images from proof sheets to expunge every picture Beard had ever taken of her. It took 4 days. Next photo, blood type. Snows of Kilimanjaro, 1972, features Beard's signature handworking technique. Not long after his divorce from Teagues, Beard got married for the third time to Nima Kanum, a woman he had met in Kenya. Nima declined to be interviewed, stating through a spokeswoman that she is not feeling herself. From the start, their pairing was rocky. While the couple was dating, Nima's parents sent her from Kenya to Germany to get her away from Beard. Her late father was a judge of the Kenyan High Court, and two of her brothers are lawyers in Nairobi. But Beard tracked her down in Europe, promising her he would be faithful, and I believed him, she said, in Bond's 1998 documentary. 1 year after they married, however, Beard began a relationship with Maureen Gallagher, then a 22-year-old model whose body Beard declared a living sculpture. In his famous photo, Night Feeder, Gallagher, nude, offers food to a giraffe at Hog Ranch. That relationship would endure for 16 years. Impish is the adjective Gallagher uses to describe Beard. She also describes him as headstrong. He wanted his way, and he wanted his way, Gallagher says. I treated him like a child sometimes. They did drugs together, sometimes too many, she says. Her mood during our interview ranging between humor and tears. It was a match made in heaven, doing everything we weren't supposed to do. He needed women, says Lyon, whose affair with Beard began in the early 80s and grew into a lifelong friendship and professional relationship. It's not that he was a playboy, Lyon later adds. He was seeking to be admired, to be wanted. Barbara Allen de Kwiatkowski, model and muse to Andy Warhol, left her first husband for Beard, who was Lee Radziwill's lover at the time. I adored Peter, de Kwiatkowski says. Everybody did. He was incredibly handsome and so fun. Dickinson says she rebuffed his advances because his hands were always covered in blood and dirt. He was gorgeous and so charming, but I'm a germaphobe, she says. Over time, however, the friends and girlfriends constantly buzzing about Beard began to grate on Nima. Women didn't like his lifestyle, says Anatoly Davidov, an actor and friend. He couldn't belong to one woman. He belonged to everybody. He belonged to the world. As Teagues put it, I think he liked the beauty of women, and he liked to spin the web, and then he would walk away once he ensnared you. In the beginning, Beard's friends say, Nima tolerated Beard and his need to be the center of attention and chaos. He had an affinity for picaresque characters, mobsters and partiers, night crawlers and drug chasers, who picked up the check and supplied him with cocaine or amusing tales. But in 1988, the Beards had Zara, their only daughter, and began spending long stretches at Hog Ranch. Beard was working on a book with Gillies Turl, a Brit, who was then an antiques dealer in Nairobi. They claimed artifacts they had discovered were authentically old and made by the Maasai people. The book, The Art of the Maasai, 300 Newly Discovered Objects and Works of Art, was published in 1992. It was authored by Turrell, with photographs and art direction by Beard. Greenberg says he was responsible for the images, while Beard was the brilliant art director for the book. What was new became a question. Richard Leakey, a renowned paleoanthropologist and past president of the National Museum of Kenya, cast doubt on the authenticity of the art and artifacts, aspersions that Greenberg vigorously denies. The objects hail from the Lebons, who are the shamans of the Maasai tribe, Turrell says, adding, I collected these artifacts for 15 years. I attended ceremonies using these artifacts. If someone wants to say they're fake, they'd better explain how the Lebons had them. Beard admitted to Vanity Fair in 1996 that he had been smuggling Maasai artifacts out of Kenya, describing how he sneaked them past customs officers at the Nairobi airport. But he claimed he wasn't selling them. He said he just wanted to include objects in his show, along with photographs and collages. Peter Riva, a producer and author, and the grandson of Marlene Dietrich, once described himself to Vanity Fair as Beard's manager, agent, babysitter, and close friend, but he declined to comment for this story. Riva wasn't the only one who managed Beard. In the early 90s, Beard met Peter Tunney, a former financier who opened the Time Is Always Now gallery in Soho in 1991 and devoted its entire space to Beard's work. A year later, Tunney was the agent for Beard's art, setting up exhibitions with Beard in places like Milan, Berlin, and Vienna, and helping to arrange 5 or 6 fashion shoots. Beard was also taking giant Polaroids of models at a studio on Broadway and using them in his collages. Beard amplified his photos with substances like paint, quill pen writing, and blood, bovine and his own. His friend Lyon remembers that Beard, high on drugs, once cut himself so badly for a picture that he needed stitches. He was often casual in the handling of his finished artwork. One gallery owner, David Fay, recalls Beard actually liked the deteriorating state of an object and once sent him photos in various conditions that had been left in crates outdoors in Montauk. Beard called these additions handworking a picture, a creative effort that made each photo unique and was also financially rewarding. But Tunney's gallery soon began to double as a gathering place for Beard's friends and hangers-on. Peter had a hard time saying no, Tunney says, keeping the riffraff out. The gallery years were creatively productive for Beard, who sometimes had to be corralled into working and dissuaded from giving away his own art. But Tunney also says the heaviest drug use of Beard's life occurred during these years. As Tunney says, if Ney didn't come and break up the party, I'm pretty sure I'd be dead. By the time Zara was 7 or 8, Beard was largely living apart from his daughter Anema, who told friends and his family that she planned to divorce him. It was during this time that Anema accused Beard of molesting Zara, a claim that he and his friends strenuously denounced, and one that she defended in the 1996 Vanity Fair story. In the same article, Nema said it was Beard's choice to stop seeing Zara. A quarter century later, Zara sets the record straight for herself. It is absolutely untrue, she says, of her mother's accusation. It's disgusting. It absolutely destroyed him. He doesn't deserve his name attached to that story. Zara explains that there is a story around the false charge that she cannot discuss, emphasizing that her mother is not to blame. Next photo, Labor of Love. Nema and Peter Beard photographed in 2003 in Montauk, where Beard owned a sprawling compound and spent his last years. At the time of the molestation allegation, Nema and Zara moved into the Greenwich, Connecticut home of Beard's brother, Anson M. Beard, Jr., according to his son, Anson H. Beard. Zara was evaluated at Yale New Haven Hospital, and there was no evidence that she had been molested, he says. Beard's friends and family say he adored his daughter. I don't think he ever loved anyone, Tunney says, except Zara. In September 1996, Beard was trampled by a female elephant, concerned about the safety of her young calf. She crushed his pelvis and pierced his bladder and hip. Bonn, filming for the documentary, caught the accident on tape. As a broken Beard was carried into the back seat of a car, he quipped to Qatar, "My days of screwing are over." Perhaps not, but he would spend the rest of his life in pain. When Beard returned to New York for further hospitalization and physical rehabilitation, he reunited with Nema, and any divorce plans were called off. Julian Schnabel, a friend of Nema and Peter's, is insistent that the perception of Nema not be one of a controlling or long-suffering wife. After a lengthy interview, he calls back and says, "It doesn't get reported how cool she was, and how much she brought to his life, and how she gave him a family," Schnabel says. I think Peter expected her to clean up stuff for him. He later adds, "I think she was trying to protect him from himself. If someone is being very self-destructive, and you love them, where do you draw the line?" Of course they had difficulties as a couple, Dementon says. When you have a man like that by your side, you don't have a normal life. It was Nema who advised Beard to spend time in the south of France, because too many people were dropping by the Montauk house. He needed inspiration and to get away from the parasites and harpies, Nema told the Wall Street Journal. Beard stayed in Cassis for long stretches between 2004 and 2010. He was really happy there, Lyon says. He loved France. Nema gradually took over as Beard's agent. As prices for Beard's work rose, she organized his archive, began selling his work directly to clients, reported stolen works to the Art Loss Register, and would sometimes insist that works Beard had loaned to friends weren't intended as outright gifts. A number of lawsuits followed. Some resulted in judgments favorable to the Beards or confidential settlements, but at a price. Court records revealed tawdry or unflattering details about the couple. In two cases dating from the same October 2013 photo shoot, where Beard was to take pictures of high-profile models, Beard claimed he was drunk while signing the contract and that he suffered from vision and hearing loss as well as confusional episodes. Other testimony indicated he had fantasies about strangling his wife. In a separate case, Beard was commissioned by Bernie Chase, a collector, to take pictures and handwork his photos in the fall of 2013. The Beards successfully sued Chase, claiming he took three artworks to sell without Peter's consent. The case is under appeal. Depositions reveal that 911 dispatchers were told that Beard was threatening suicide, an assertion he later denied. Other people asserted that Beard had friends manage money for him without Nema's knowledge. One friend, Elizabeth Fekai, said she arranged for a sale of Beard's work so he could pay a $26,700 dental bill. He also allegedly sold work without Nema's knowledge, including to pay a $10,000 bill for a girlfriend. A wall went up, put there by his wife, says Nellie Pock, a model and friend whom Beard photographed in Montauk. Pock's husband, businessman Emery Pock, had trouble reaching him by phone in the fall of 2019. Concern mounting, Emery and another of Beard's friends, real estate developer Jacques Guillet, drove out to Montauk. They found Beard sitting outside, playing with a dog, a caregiver not far away. He was so happy to have the company, Emery Pock says. Guillet recalls Beard joyfully pointing out surfers. Before Beard departed with Zara for a doctor's appointment, the three men hugged each other goodbye. But the next morning, Gaye says he got a call from the state police with a request from Beard's family. Could they call ahead next time and make an appointment? Which brings us back to the diaries. They are the key into some of the myths that he used to filter his understanding of the continent of Africa, says Lewis. For Lewis, the oft-reproduced image of Beard at Lake Rudolph, writing in a diary while stuffed in the mouth of a dead crocodile, is an emblematic self-portrait of a risk-taking artist, one who aligned himself viscerally with a continent he didn't fully understand. Whether Beard's legacy continues a presence in Kenya remains to be seen. Behind on Kenyan tax payments and displeased with suburban encroachment, Beard sold Hog Ranch in late 1996 for $500,000 to the nonprofit Africa Fund for Endangered Wildlife. AFEW funds Giraffe Center, a conservation preserve that supplies the long-legged ungulates to the nearby luxury resort Giraffe Manor. The money was to be paid in annual installments of $25,000. There was an agreement that Beard have life tenancy. However, Beard's nephew, Jamie Beard, says AFEW has not met the payment terms of the contract. The purchase price has not been paid in full. Therefore, he says, the Peter Beard estate still controls the property. Our hope is that it ends up very amicably, says Jamie Beard. The most important thing to my uncle is that the land remain a preserve. Rick Anderson, who owns Giraffe Center with his wife, Brioni, says the sale contract was never executed. Anderson concedes that at one time, receipts went missing, and there was a question about whether Beard had received the payments. To remedy this, about 5 years ago, AFEW put $75,000, the total remaining payments, in an escrow account. The money was to be released to Beard when Beard signed the title transfer, but Beard never signed it, Anderson says. It's been 5 years, Anderson says, and Peter just died, so therefore his lease has expired. Beard's death leaves other questions, these directed at his health and happiness during his last months. There were worries, some friends whisper, about his being lonely in the care of paid help. Khadija Adam, a former Miss Kenya, says his friends would have come to Montauk to take care of him, had Nema asked. So he wasn't left like that. Dementon insists he was content because Zara had recently given birth to a girl she named Daisy. I talked with Peter 3 days before he died, Dementon says. He was very happy to be a grandfather. Find out what really happened to him, Adam implored. Although Beard's death, according to the police, is not a mystery. In the 18 months before he died, Beard needed constant attention. He had a hip replacement in 2012 and prostate cancer surgery in 2013. There was evidence of dementia, according to police. During the pandemic, when his regular caregiver had returned to her family, Nema was looking after Beard. Usually, she worked in the city during the week, staying at the couple's apartment on West 57th Street, returning to Montauk on the weekends. Now, Nema was in Montauk during the week to take care of her husband. When Peter first went missing, around 4:40 p.m., a family member said that Nema looked for Peter and then searched with neighbors. The police were called around 6:25 p.m. Although multiple strokes and dementia had left Beard searching for words, he had many moments of lucidity. Initially, some friends imagined he set out for excitement, without a phone or wallet as usual. It was cold that night, and several of the following nights, and he did not have his heart medication with him. Dozens of police and volunteer drones, helicopters, dogs, and heat mapping technology searched for him. 3 weeks later, a local hunter spotted Beard's body in Camp Hero State Park, in the brushy woods between the road to Beard's home and Route 27. A death certificate is on file in surrogate's court, but remains sealed in compliance with federal privacy laws. In July, East Hampton Town Police Captain Chris Anderson reiterated that there was no sign of foul play. Where was Beard going? One relative thinks Beard wandered off to investigate because he'd been obsessed with the idea that someone was illegally building on his property. Another says he still took the occasional solo walk. A few people speculated that Beard didn't want to get any frailer and might have committed suicide by swimming out into the Atlantic. He pointed out old people in pushchairs around town and said, "If I ever end up like that, I'll just go into the sea," says Lyon, who lives in Montauk. I told him, "The sharks will get you," and he said, "Annie, there are worse ways to go." "I was hopeful he would never be found," says Alex Beard. "That would have been the perfect epitaph." They went to Jared. As the COVID crisis spiraled, President Trump's son-in-law took charge and unleashed chaos. Jared Kushner commissioned an ambitious testing plan, then tabled it, He met with business leaders eager to source supplies, then rebuffed them, and he enlisted a former roommate to lead a consultant state to take on the so-called deep state, with results ranging from the Eastman Kodak fiasco to a mysterious deal to send ventilators to Russia. By Catherine Eben, with opening illustration of Jared Kushner by Christopher Buzzelli. On the evening of Saturday, March 21st, a small group of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, business executives, and venture capitalists gathered in the White House Situation Room to offer their help to the Trump administration as it confronted a harrowing shortage of life-saving supplies to battle COVID-19. More than 7 weeks after the federal government learned that a new and lethal coronavirus was barreling toward U.S. shores, hospitals were pleading for masks, gloves, and other personal protective equipment to safeguard their medical staff. Intensive care nurses had been photographed wearing garbage bags instead of gowns. More than 19,600 Americans had been diagnosed with the disease, and at least 260 had died. The meeting's attendees, some present, some dialing in, were a bipartisan collection of heavy hitters. The ad hoc group had spent weeks canvassing America's private sector to map the shortages and draft a plan to solve them. Briefly using a hotel ballroom in Washington, D.C. as a makeshift headquarters, they sought answers to some urgent questions. What capacity did America's companies have to manufacture protective equipment and medical supplies? What supplies could be ordered now? Were there hidden reserves? They had secured commitments from dozens of major corporations to manufacture ventilators, map supply needs, create a system for contact tracing, and much more. A day earlier, on Friday, March 20th, this same collective had met with a large group of officials at the Federal Emergency Management Agency, people one attendee described as the doers, to strategize how best to replenish the nation's depleted reserves of PPE. The attendees had gotten a significant pledge from, among many others, Mary Barra, the CEO of General Motors. Her company could reconfigure a production line to make ventilators, so long as the federal government would commit to purchasing them. To accomplish that, the private sector attendees and the FEMA officials discussed the need for President Donald Trump to invoke a federal law called the Defense Production Act, which would unleash the government's procurement powers. As one attendee recounted, certain government officials there had implored the group to return the next day to the White House for a follow-up with Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor Jared Kushner to make the case for invoking the Defense Production Act. Earlier in the month, Kushner had formed a coronavirus shadow task force running parallel to the official one helmed by Vice President Mike Pence. The meeting at the White House on Saturday began at 6:30 p.m. Kushner is an observant Jew and normally wouldn't work during Shabbat, which ended at 8 that evening, but a rabbinic dispensation allows him to make exceptions for matters of public importance, according to a senior administration official. Those representing the private sector expected to learn about a sweeping government plan to procure supplies and direct them to the places they were needed most. New York, home to more than a third of the nation's coronavirus cases, seemed like an obvious candidate. In turn, they came armed with specific commitments of support: a memo on the merits of the Defense Production Act, a document outlining impediments to the private sector response, and two key questions: how could they best help? And how could they best support the government strategy? What actually transpired in the room stunned a number of those in attendance. Vanity Fair has reconstructed the details of the meeting for the first time, based on recollections, notes, and calendar entries from three people who attended the meeting. All quotations are based on the recollections of one or more individual attendees. Kushner, seated at the head of the conference table, in a chair taller than all the others, was quick to strike a confrontational tone. "The federal government is not going to lead this response," he announced. "It's up to the states to figure out what they want to do." One attendee explained to Kushner that due to the finite supply of PPE, Americans were bidding against each other and driving prices up. To solve that, businesses eager to help were looking to the federal government for leadership and direction. "Free markets will solve this," Kushner said dismissively. "That is not the role of government." The same attendee explained that although he believed in open markets, he feared that the system was breaking. As evidence, he pointed to a CNN report about New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and his desperate call for supplies. "That's the CNN bullshit," Kushner snapped. "They lie." According to another attendee, Kushner then began to rail against the governor. "Cuomo didn't pound the phones hard enough to get PPE for his state. His people are going to suffer, and that's their problem." "That's when I was like, we're screwed," the shocked attendee told Vanity Fair. The group, arguing for invoking the Defense Production Act, "We were all saying, Mr. Kushner, if you want to fix this problem for PPE and ventilators, there's a path to do it, but you have to make a policy change," one person who attended the meeting recounted. In response, Kushner got very aggressive, the attendee recalled. He kept invoking the markets and told the group they only understood how entrepreneurship works, but didn't understand how government worked. "Though Kushner's arguments made no sense," said the attendee, "there seemed to be little hope of changing his mind. It felt like Kushner was the president. He sat in the chair, and he was clearly making the decisions." Kushner was accompanied by Navy Rear Admiral John Palachuk, who had just been posted to FEMA to lead supply chain efforts. He heaped flattery on Kushner, calling his ideas brilliant, and expressed skepticism concerning the motives of those in the room and on the phone. "Are you trying to hawk your wares on us?" he asked one participant. Ultimately, there was little follow-up from the government on the group's offers. Trump invoked the Defense Production Act in name a week later, but he didn't immediately use it to formally order supplies, sparking confusion and delays. He also rage-tweeted at Barra, "Always a mess with Mary B." The government waited until April 8th to announce its first order of ventilators from GM. "We had so much potential to commandeer against this," said one person who attended the meeting. "We had a real system for contact tracing, the world's best mobile engineers on standby. There was a real opportunity to have a coordinated response." That attendee said he remains angry over the federal government's intransigence in stockpiling supplies and feels certain that people died because of it. "At the time, I just thought of it as blind capitalism and extreme libertarian ideals gone wrong," he said. "In hindsight, it's not crazy to think it was some purposeful belief that it was okay if Cuomo had a tough go of it because New York was a blue state." According to another attendee, it seemed very clear Kushner was less interested in finding a solution because at the time the virus was primarily ravaging cities in blue states. "We were flabbergasted. I basically had an out-of-body experience. Where am I, and what happened to America?" In response to a request for comment, a senior administration official told Vanity Fair that the meeting was not confrontational and said the attendees' impressions were not rooted in reality. He said the federal government had sourced over a billion items of PPE, enough ventilators so that no American was denied one, and we are the leading testing country in the world. He added that the vast majority of the federal response was aimed at helping blue states, and pointed to public statements Cuomo had made in which he said Kushner had been extraordinarily helpful. White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany had this to say, "This story is another inaccurate and disgusting partisan hit job. President Trump has consistently put the health of all Americans first." At the end of July, writing for Vanity Fair, I revealed that Kushner had commissioned a robust federal COVID-19 testing plan, only to abandon it before it could be implemented. The story struck a nerve, partly because it painted a picture of what might have been. The administration could have invested in a national testing system at a scale that could have greatly limited the number of cases and deaths. Instead, the U.S. passed the grim milestone of 200,000 official COVID-19 deaths in September. With just 4% of the world's population, we accounted for 20% of global deaths from the virus that month. After the story was published, I pressed on with my reporting, hoping to learn more about Kushner's operation. I also wanted to better understand how the U.S., with its advanced medical systems, unmatched epidemiological know-how, and vaunted regulatory and public health institutions, could have fumbled its response to the crisis so disastrously. Part of the answer almost certainly lies in the deep-seated belief held by Kushner, Trump, and their loyalist that the federal government not only should not, but cannot play an effective leading role in responding to the pandemic, owing to its lumbering bureaucracy and onerous rules. At almost every step, they have ignored the expertise of career officials and dismissed those with relevant experience as counterproductive meddlers. Trump famously calls them the deep state. A senior administration official denied this, saying, "The administration worked diligently to combine the best of the federal government and the private sector." Though even a well-coordinated federal response would have posed extreme challenges, it could have followed a clearly marked trail. Early on, Trump could have tapped into the vast procurement powers of the federal government. The Defense Production Act, a Korean War-era law, allows the president to direct U.S. businesses to manufacture supplies and gives the federal government first dibs on buying them. It was an obvious solution to a crisis that threatened the life of every American citizen. When the military needs to buy planes and make bullets, it doesn't rely on the invisible hand of the free market, said Jeremy Krundig, a senior policy fellow at the Center for Global Development, who helped lead the Obama administration's response to the 2014 Ebola outbreak. "It uses the Defense Production Act because it's urgent," he said. But as experts watched and waited, Trump shied away from invoking the act, which he later deployed haphazardly. A senior administration official said Trump has invoked the Defense Production Act dozens of times when appropriate. Instead, he put his faith in the entrepreneurial instincts of his son-in-law, and Kushner wasn't interested in a big government solution. Kushner set out to reinvent what a response might look like, countering the deep state with what you might call a consultant state of his own creation. This might have been a worthwhile experience had it not taken place in the context of a once-in-a-century public health catastrophe. As it is, it has led to organizational chaos, futile misadventures, and most tellingly, a steadily climbing death rate. Often communicating using the encrypted platform WhatsApp with little adherence to public records laws or federal contracting guidelines, Kushner and a tight-knit group of allies he's recruited have overseen a response riddled with special favors and political calculation. When they managed to procure life-saving equipment, they used the surplus to shore up the president's relationship with Russia, hijacking a foreign aid agency in the process. And when they made a deal to bring drug manufacturing home to the United States, it blew up amid accusations of financial fraud. "What you have going on here is smoke and mirrors," said Larry Hall, who retired last year as director of the Defense Production Act Program Division at FEMA. "You do not have a national strategy." From the beginning of his involvement in the pandemic, Kushner said about sidelining government experts in favor of young, untested volunteers drawn from consulting firms and investment banks like McKinsey and Goldman Sachs. Using personal email accounts and working under non-disclosure agreements, the volunteers were supposed to use their private sector savvy to source leads on protective equipment, then turn those leads over to FEMA. They operated at the direction of a former Goldman Sachs analyst and a 2014 Princeton University graduate named Rachel Batel, who'd previously worked as a special assistant to Ivanka Trump at the White House. Before getting into finance, she'd also worked as a denim intern at Ralph Lauren. Batel's group eventually spawned its own whistleblower, who alleged in a letter to a congressional subcommittee that the group maintained a spreadsheet titled VIP Update that gave priority to tips from political allies and friends, according to reports in the New York Times and Washington Post. A senior administration official involved in the task force said the young financial analyst provided an efficient solution to an unprecedented problem. Dubious leads on supplies were flooding in from around the world. In the first tier of a venture capital firm, you receive incoming calls from your investment firm. You vet them. You pre-qualify them. Those volunteers were able to step through the mishmash and figure out the leads to pursue. The journalist, Duff McDonald, author of The Firm, The Story of McKinsey and Its Secret Influence on American Business, said it's common for private sector CEOs to use management consultants as a crutch when they are out of their depth and don't want to be blamed for what goes wrong. Kushner is at a loss for how to stall what is happening, so he's doing the classic analyst punt, McDonald said, going to his pals at McKinsey instead of people in the deep state who can do their jobs today. These are people who think, if you have a quantitative grasp, you can manage anything. I have no doubt that they're telling Kushner he's a genius as well. One attorney who worked at a private company that conferred with the government on procuring PPE described the Kushner team's interactions with colleagues as off the books, completely irregular. The attorney said a common refrain from Batel was, "We have to figure out a way around this." This being the government procurement laws that Kushner and his team believed were an obstacle to quick action. Their strategy, the lawyer said, amounted to call the people we see at Davos and have them go get stuff for us. Some career officials within the so-called deep state view Kushner and his deputies with intense skepticism, referring to them derisively as the slim suit crowd. One of the most prominent members of the slim suit crowd is a man who, in a White House that values loyalty above all else, seems to have the ultimate credential. He roomed with Kushner for a summer in the NYU dorms when they were both college students interning at different investment banks. Kushner later attended his wedding. On March 12th, the day after Pence pulled Kushner into the pandemic response, Kushner reached out to his old friend, Adam Baylor, who was serving in the administration as the CEO of the U.S. International Development Finance Corporation. A newly created development bank within the federal government tasked with making loans overseas. Tapping Baylor was not a terrible idea. Formerly a healthcare executive, he had founded an innovative startup called Landmark Health, which brought primary care to the homes of underserved, chronically ill patients. Andy Slavitt, a former Obama administration health care official who has served as a sounding board for Baylor, told me, "This is a guy who can work 20 hours a day. If he gets one more ventilator to save one more life, that's the name of the game." But to some of the besieged healthcare officials who began fielding his directives, Baylor was a government neophyte and an unaccountable agent of chaos. They felt the same way about Battelle, who became his deputy chief of staff at the DFC. Baylor approached the pandemic response like a management consultant looking to slash red tape. He shared Trump and Kushner's quasi-messianic belief in the private sector's ability to respond effectively to the crisis and their contempt for government capabilities. On April 30th, Baylor appeared as a guest on the podcast run by Michael Milken, the American financier who pleaded guilty to securities and tax violations in 1990 and was pardoned by Trump 3 decades later. "My job has been to bring public and private together and to work to drive very quick action," Baylor said. Baylor described public-private partnerships as a big focus of the president, Jared, and me. He added, "We get asked all the time, how come we're not throwing Defense Production Act orders all over the place? It's not necessary when you have the private market taking all the right actions to support Americans." In reality, the private sector not only needed, but wanted federal leadership. Everyone involved was begging for the federal government to figure out the needs, make a very big order at a very fair price, and scientifically figure out how to distribute PPE, said a software company CEO who worked on the pandemic response. Those in private industry trying to procure supplies did not want to bid against fellow Americans in need or act as distributors. "We don't want to decide who lives and who dies," the CEO said. "In a bidding war without federal guidance, everyone is going to overbuy and overpay. That is the definition of the tragedy of the commons. Everyone accidentally creates a worse outcome for everybody." Baylor made it clear that he viewed agencies like FEMA, with their deep reserves of experience, as too slow and cumbersome to respond to the pandemic. "FEMA is set up to respond to hurricanes," as he told Milken. "But the coronavirus is like hurricanes in every one of the 50 states and the 2 territories at the same time." When it comes to the pandemic response, Baylor has become Kushner's key aide-de-camp. He has had a hand in everything from the aborted testing plan in April to the push in late August to approve convalescent plasma therapy over the objections of officials at the National Institutes of Health, including Anthony Fauci. According to some colleagues and friends, Baylor is just the kind of person you'd want involved in the government's response. Next photo, loyalty, loyalty, loyalty. Adam Baylor, a key player in the federal pandemic response, roomed with Jared Kushner during college. "Kushner wisely recognized that Adam Baylor knows a lot about healthcare," said Bob Coker, MD, partner at the healthcare venture capital firm Venrock, who helped overhaul California's system for COVID-19 diagnostic testing and interacted with Baylor during that work. "For all his talents, however, Baylor's track record leaves much to be desired. A survey of initiatives bearing his fingerprints reveals that at a time when Americans desperately needed a large-scale intervention to protect the health of the most vulnerable among us, he and Kushner expended valuable time on political favors and blame-shifting exercises. Inside the White House over much of March and early April, Kushner's hand-picked group of young business associates, including Baylor, teamed up with several top experts from the diagnostic testing industry. Together, they hammered out a national strategy to test Americans for COVID-19. The group, working night and day using the encrypted platform WhatsApp, emerged with a detailed plan obtained by Vanity Fair. Rather than have states fight each other for scarce diagnostic tests and limited lab capacity, the plan would have set up a system of national oversight and coordination to surge supplies, allocate test kits, lift regulatory and contractual roadblocks, and establish a widespread virus surveillance system by the fall to help pinpoint subsequent outbreaks. The solutions it proposed weren't rocket science, or even comparable to the dauntingly complex undertaking of developing a vaccine. Any national plan to address testing deficits would likely be more on the level of replicating UPS for an industry, said Mike Pollini, MD, the managing partner of Section 32, a technology and healthcare venture capital fund. Imagine if UPS or FedEx didn't have infrastructure to connect all the dots. It would be complete chaos. The plan crafted at the White House then set out to connect the dots. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.